This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
So, Cecil, it's so great to have you here, and hopefully in the next 30 minutes or so we can make legible for everyone here some of the conversations you're trying to stage and perform. I have about 10 questions. The first kind of begins from something that you suggest in Crossover, that there's a narrative power of architecture. And in particular, in Crossover, you dwell on the narrative of uncertainty. A lot of the narrative that courses through these disparate projects concerns uncertainty as something that enables architecture and mathematics to thrive. At one point, you say that uncertainty is what a building is supposed to perform and provoke. Uncertainty characterizes literally crossing over as you perform here between Lao Tse and Confucius, between metaphor and substance, between the virtual and the physical. There's all sorts of performing and performativity that's being staged here. So I was wondering if you could talk more about this. Am I correct that it doesn't resolve itself in any permanent way, that this is kind of an ongoing process, a tenuous process, not one that you ever conclude?
Yeah, I mean, there are basically three kinds of architecture, in a way, broadly. There's vernacular architecture, which has grown and evolved to be what it is. There is functional architecture, which doesn't get the attention of any architects, sadly. So factories, hospitals, straight extrusion, whatever. And then you get the other architecture. I wouldn't say landmark or significant in that sense, but outside vernacular and functional. There's a whole attempt at your homes, villas, offices. I think that when the architect designing is working off by rote, working by cliche, working back on past reference, the project, we can tell, has no special life. It's okay, you can go and come, but it doesn't have any resonance. I believe that you need a certain tension in the resolution of architectural spaces. Now, all good architects do that, some instinctively, some by mapping forms. And the tension is unresolved in a good work because you come back and come back. If it was resolved, you'd be satisfied from the beginning. And that would suit some people. But generally, I think architecture that has buildings, I'm talking now, that has certain tension in its resolution, so it's not resolved. And it doesn't mean it's gapped or something, but actually as you move through the building, you get different readings. And it's on the edge of some kind of precariousness. I think the Bordeaux Villa is a very, very good contemporary example of something on the edge of the pot. It looks balanced. It certainly works the same as this table does, except the supports are flying all over the place. If you take Hagia Sophia, building I visit every time I go to Istanbul to inspire me, it looks like it shouldn't be there. This dome just floats. It's unbelievable, the circle coming down on the square with all these squinches working. 350 AD, those Turkish architects did something amazing. It's amazing. It works as one of the favorite buildings in the world because of that. So I think, and those tensions will give narrative power if you're skillful enough in using and underlining that with your materiality and your texture.
So if this is not a typical book, if this is meant to be understood, as you said, as a manual or a guide, then
more a guide, not a manual.
But a guide. Okay. Then, in a way, the argument would be that we should kind of inhabit that tension, that uncertainty.
Yeah, I mean, what I'd say, if you go through the whole book, all the projects have this moment of speculation, wild speculation in a way, of an unknown something. The Serpentine Pavilion, we first started with, oh, let's have something random. So we drew some lines on the roof and then had columns regularly all around it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, why do that? Why not just have straight columns and a Greek model and straight beams? Why go and have a crazy roof? Then that provoked, Ito then sent me a little fax those days before email, saying, why don't you look at your old algorithms? So I looked at the Chemnitz algorithm of the stadium and the V&A spiraling forms. I started looking back and I thought, that's the way to go. One kind of algorithm that makes this whole thing work. And I thought of Hyde Park. I saw an aerial shot and I saw all the lines whizzing across Hyde Park of people movements. So I thought, what better than to capture velocity in a small capsule? But by capturing velocity, I wouldn't be confining you. I would be releasing you at speed. So that was the metaphorical notion before I even saw anything like that. And then I jumped into what is it then? And I confer with my guys and suddenly we came up with various tests and led to that. So, you know, that uncertainty, I think, goes through. There's something, if you visited the pavilion, you'd find that your eye moves and you feel yet restful. There is something that kept people there. Nobody left when we had an event. You had to push them out, close the lights. So something happens. I don't know what it is, but I think those pieces of architecture that are compiled through a process that's not that predictable has a certain something in it.
I want to ask a related question about risk. Typically, at least from my lay perspective, I always assume that architects and engineers are trying to mitigate or minimize risk. It seems that you've taken a very different approach. You're trying to almost embrace it. And I'm interested in if you could talk more about this, like in the CCTV kind of diagrams about how it would withstand the earthquake that you were speaking about, how the building would undulate. I was interested in how you were almost seeking out risk and in a way that seemed to me quite unusual. And I was interested, is there a limit? Is there a limit to how much you can kind of embrace risk, or is that really not the way that you approach
risk? I think risk is calculated risk in the end. If you're a professional, you take risk deliberately to open up your mind. I've had all my career to throw away the baggage of whatever I've learned. So, you know, I had a sort of Damascene moment when I was about 35, walked out, had a cigarette, and thought, I can't go back and do what I'm doing. So immediately I went back and started reading early Greek texts, all various things. Prime myself to rethink. And I think I'm constantly doing that. So that's risky in that you don't know. All the projects I showed had no legacy, had no reference. There was never a skyscraper that went that way and came back down. What do you do? Do you run away from it? Or do you think that's what I want? And then go for it.
But this is not just an intellectual engagement with risk. This is like an architecture of risk.
Yes, the architecture of risk in a way is more sublimated and controlled in the previous discussion about tension in form, and we do it also through compression of ceilings and narrow gateways, but also the whole way it's being compiled. It can very easily take a row of columns, as I did in the Kunsthal, and just slightly stagger them, and suddenly the space is released from being a restricted space. So I'm always trying to open up the dynamic of a space. It has its own walls and confines and boundaries and exits and entrances, but the space itself can be more alive by these processes. So in that sense, there's risk in not knowing what's been done before. On the technical side then, CCTV is a major risk, no question.
Structurally?
Yeah, no question. Structurally, that was almost insane to do. Who the hell would do that, you know? And as Rem said, how come these guys in Arab never say no? You know, because he was egged on by me, and we had this very famous conversation one night, what shall we do? Shall we go for it? It was a competition. And we knew Ito would go flat and low level. And Chinese wanted an icon, and we thought, you can't go low level with an icon, so let's go up. And so then Chinese ideogram came in and various things happened. But the idea of the risk there was phenomenal, that's for sure. And it's only, I remember the chairman of the CCTV committee interviewing me after we submitted and won the competition. He said, can you do this? And I took a huge breath, looked at him straight and said, I don't know how. You know, and Rem nearly died. He was next to me saying, oh my God. You know, because he wanted me to say it's all perfect. And I thought I couldn't lie because I actually didn't know how.
I mean, he wanted you to perform certainty.
Yeah. So, but what I said to the Chinese was, I said, but you're talking to someone who's heading an organization that did the Sydney Opera House, did Centre Pompidou, did whatever, you know, all these impossible things. So this, that process of learning how to do the impossible will happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I have another related question. So taking us back to, takes us back to that first project that you presented on with Anish Kapoor, the collaboration for the Tate Modern. Mm-hmm. So you kind of lay out in your text that there's been a mathematical testing, there's been a technical essaying in a speculative way that's enabled this work, and that it kind of, as you narrate its kind of installation, you talk about kind of this moment of excitement suddenly colliding with anxiety. You think about, and you talk very explicitly here about almost wanting to flee the scene, to catch a flight, to escape what looks like it's going to be a spectacular failure. And you say this is the moment that every designer dreads, when dreams become nightmares.
Yeah. But, true, absolutely
but,
true.
But then, of course, this is an unfolding narrative, much like all of the projects and the book itself. And so in the end, the fabrication process is what has produced this mistake. It gets resolved. And you write in this very literary and narrativistic way, the murder scene is cleaned up and all previous evidence of the horror is gone. And so I was wondering if you could...
totally true, all of it.
Talk more about this. Yeah.
Oh, it was horrendous. It's one of those moments you dread. You know, you take risk. You know, no one had... I remember we talked about this fabric structure. And Anish had done a fabric structure about 30 meters high in north of England. And it looked like it was made out of cloth. It wrinkled, it was cloth. And I wanted something different, like Zaha thought it was made out of metal. So the idea here that I knew technically was almost impossible was to have a structure, a fabric, stretch 400 feet, 1/16 of an inch thick, 1 millimeter, just a little over, and have no wrinkles. That's almost impossible, because as you stretch the fabric, things happen to it. How do you control it? So huge analyses go on, and you know, completely, literally non-linear analyses, which are phenomenally converging gradually to an answer. Massive computing power, could not be done otherwise. And a series of world experts.
But can you talk?
But then the thing was, one night, so everything's going smooth, everyone's happy, and then the opening was the next day at 3 p.m. or something. 2 days before, I get a call from the director of the Tate saying, I think there's a problem, you better come down. Because I've been always telling him, well, there might be a little bit of wrinkle or something, but you know, you won't see it. So I get there and find disaster, right? Total wrinkles everywhere. And you just die, you know, you think, oh my God, the opening, public opening is in 36 hours or something. And what do you do? You know, everyone just freezes. I froze. And I just sit there thinking, what has gone wrong? You know, obviously first thinking the whole process of analysis is wrong. Everything's wrong. Never thought that the fabrication was erroneous somewhere, because I thought, these guys are experts. We've made the mistake, you know. So I was thinking about it. I sat down in the end after 2 hours with the computer. I got my best guy to come. And I just said, let's play all sorts of tunes on the computer to just see. And gradually as we were doing that, my confidence level grew again that what I had done was right, that it had to be something wrong with this fabric. So I went and checked it, and then suddenly this revelation moment, the holes that were drilled on one side of one ring had been drilled on the wrong side, and the ring had been put in the wrong place, which that ring was that big, that would account for all the stretching and all the wrinkles. Amazingly, we called a meeting with the contractor who found guys from Germany, flew them, I don't know how, and they worked right through the night, right through the next day, and I was gradually watching this thing happening, thinking, but you know, is it going to work? And then gradually the wrinkles started coming out, the ring was turned, you could see it, and I thought, we're going to be okay. But literally, 10 hours before that, I was facing total disaster. I mean, what do you do? You know, I'd said it would work. It would be smooth, clean, look like steel, and it would have been a mess. Not even an art object, certainly not an art object. It would have like a bad attempt structural object. So it was a terrible moment, and it was literally like a murder scene cleaned up, because when everything was taken away, we couldn't believe we had this shock where everyone went, why? And everybody, the director was dying, Nicholas Sirota, you know, he couldn't believe it. And then everyone was happy again, and champagne and cocktails came. The last bit of thing was cleaned up. I couldn't believe it. I thought, oh, wow, what was that all about? So
I'm interested in
how... I never want to repeat that moment, though.
But I'm interested in how that rhetorical trope of vulnerability and risk plays out in each of the projects in different ways, and how you go to great lengths to write about and to make public what might otherwise be something that one might be embarrassed by, let's say, or somebody else might be. But I had a bit of a provocation. If this is a book about risk, don't we need to talk about failures that weren't kind of, let's say, remedied and kind of the last hours?
Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah, it's really not about risk in a way. The book is not about risk, because you're dead right. If it was about risk, then you'd have to talk failure. And certainly understanding failure is the minimum condition to even negotiate risk. So I've studied lots of failures. So failure in engineering terms is easy and spectacular and loss of life or whatever. Failure in architectural terms is much harder, because it's hidden or you forgive it or whatever. You know, it's not directly impacting on you apart from your aesthetic sense or functionality. So it's really, I would have written about failure with conditions of my own failures, but because the way I trial and error the process, you do converge to an answer of a calculated risk. So it's really not risk in the sense of risky. It is a professional, hard-bitten team homing in on a certain methodology that implants tension into the architectural forms. Sometimes literally, like in the Bordeaux house. But if you see my new work, the thing in Saudi Arabia, the forms just move around, all integrated, static, safe, but they've got another thing going on with them.
Okay, I'm going out of order. I know I had briefly kind of given you a preview of some of these questions. This is one that I didn't talk to you about before. The CCTV kind of structure, building, at one point you write about it being gigantic, but having a pattern that would carry the eye in an intimate way. The shape could be a living thing, you write, a monster maybe, used that word before, but approachable. And then you, elsewhere in that same kind of chapter, you reference the overhang as being very scary, which is not a word that I had encountered elsewhere, like for instance with the Serpentine pavilions, you're not referring to them in that way. And later you even refer to it as a fortress that must stand, absorb, and repel. This is no one battle, but a series of forecast wars, you remark. And so I'm interested in this kind of language, which departs from the language you've used elsewhere in the book. And I wonder, is this a place where the work becomes political? And what kind of character or personification are you ascribing to the building when you talk about it as monster and as kind of fortress? And like,
I use those words to activate myself as well and the reader. I mean, I'm writing for people who read this book. And I'm being honest about it, because I think when you depart from normal scales, you're in some other territory. None of us knew what territory we were in CCTV.
Both structurally and politically.
No, nobody. Yeah, politically, we knew it was going to be a tough call. But you don't design architectural events like that or interventions generally to be political in a way. You deal what you think's right. Consequences are political, maybe, but essentially you're dealing with cultural artifacts, and you're moving out of your comfort zone when you're in these big forms. Scale is blown apart. You have no idea what you're into. So I create these words, and it's a series of words, and their meanings cross over each other anyway. So the Great Wall of China was to keep people out. CCTV is the biggest absorber, shock absorber there is in the world today. It absorbs everything coming its way, shakes it around, pushes it around, and stays up. So I use these words deliberately. They are sometimes clashing with each other. And because ultimately the building is the hugest pragmatic thing, it's a building, the structure is absolutely functional, takes a 2,000-year earthquake. My God, you know, no building has been designed for that. Like that, standing up in the sky. So it's, and each joint was tuned like a piano. So each joint of CCTV, incredibly, is allowed to go, technically, it's allowed to go on a serious earthquake to go plastic It pushes past its elastic limit, immediately forces move to other parts of the building, and gradually you tune the building up, and all those joints are tuned up to be able to take all this. So it's like a massive resonator as well. There's another word I could have used. But I always saw it as some kind of vast serpent, some kind of animal crawling up, bending over itself, coming back in the ground, because it was skin. That project's all about skin in its standing up form. In its architectural form, every floor plate changes as well, because we took a tough decision to not incline the lifts, but keep the lifts straight. And that changes your floor plates everywhere as you go on. And that's a huge problem for the client, potentially. But then talking to them about how we overlaid that, they've accepted it. So there were architectural risks in that, for sure.
In a related way, elsewhere you kind of use keywords or you make comments like, you speak about your paranoia at one point with the CCTV project, you talk about fear. And I was really taken by this human dimension to your work that was really revealing and helpful for me to understand. But it also seemed to suggest that you weren't just trying to seek the approval of a client in these moments. You were also seeking to maybe affirm your own process and kind of
All the time you are combating yourself. Basically, it's like the Coimbra Bridge. You know, after years of practice, I draw a thing that doesn't meet. That was my concept. The bridge will not meet. How crazy is that? I mean, it is madness, right? So, but then what do? Do you walk away from that and make it get polite again? I decided not to. So then you're fighting yourself, because all your training is saying make it straight or make it logical, make it spinal. Instead, it ends up being edgy and rotating and coming out the other side. I mean, but once I got it, I knew it was absolutely right, because it was a new typology for this condition. So it felt absolutely right. That's where your training kicks in, or your instincts, and you say, this is right now. It looks totally unusual. It's like nobody's done it, sort of thing. But then you check the cost budgets, because the other part of all of this, the client says, this looks good, but it's going to be costly, because I don't see anything like it. And you say, no. And so that bridge cost only $4 million. The bridge across the Thames, which is not much longer, cost $23 million. So it's, in the end, very functional and robust. And the stepping aside we found gave a strength laterally that a normal bridge going straight doesn't have. So that was another thing. So things happen.
You had mentioned it in the...
And basically, I'm negotiating with myself all the time, trying to convince yourself that the levels of risk you're taking are negotiable and can be overcome and can be, in the end, resolved to satisfy a client's budget, a site function, whatever. In the end, it has to work. You know, it's not a piece of art where you can look at it and say, I don't like it, or, you know, people have to walk that bridge and things have to work.
So I thought the crossover that is being foregrounded here is that it also is a work of art, in a sense.
Yeah, and I want the books themselves to be journeys. You know, I designed them myself. I take a long time on them. It took 5 years to do this book. You know, every page, every paragraph, every sentence positioned. It's all part of a trick as well, because the book is only limited. Tomorrow at the Van Allen, I will be saying what's not in the book. Book is extremely limited in one way, but when you open it up, it does radiate out speculation. And what I try to do here is, like I did in Informal, give an inner structure to the book, which is color. So that worked very well on Informal, which was a little more abstract. Here we have color pictures to deal with. So the essence of the book, much like a piece of architecture really, is in the end the balance between content to the substance. So the substance being the graphic, the diagram, the positioning, the actual aesthetic of the page. How does that take you with the content you want to express? If you just put, like a lot of graphic people do, the image, text, you end up in a cliche of a book. And a lot of architectural books suffer from that, which would be much more readable had they been thought through. What is the content going through? Sometimes the content's trivial, and the pictures can move you that way as well. All a balancing act in the end. It's a design process in the end.
Yeah, there's very different rhythms to
the very different rhythms here. And
the
it's,
discrete chapters are in fact kind
of... Also the colors are chosen to take your mood through in different ways, depending on what you are in.
And then there are these philosophical interludes that are not paginated. And that interrupt.
And I made the philosophical interludes highly dense. So they are not easy to read. They're very, very dense. And you got to struggle. You got to go through them to. But they are so small, only about 8 pages each. But it then, if you read all of them together, you get what's in this book that can't be described in the projects.
Well, I have a question or two about those philosophical meditations to end with. In the meantime, I mean, in the Serpentine Pavilion slide, you talked about the kind of let's say the distinction between the juxtaposition between the neoclassical and the flux of the structure, the rectilinear versus one that undulates. And I guess on that note, I was interested in this kind of desire to design flux or to attempt flux, and if there's an inherent difference between the different collaborations that you've taken on with artists, with architects, with Rem, with Anish Kapoor, is the process the same regardless of the collaborator? Is there like one approach that's playing itself out to flux, or is there just like a kind of each time a very different, let's say, approach being taken? Like, can you talk more about these very different collaborations?
Well, the collaborations are, you know, hard to define them because they're kind of symbiotic, and they are culturally. I mean, what Ito may do and take Caesar at one end, right? One of the best sort of entertaining collaborations I had with Alvaro Caesar. But it's. I mean, Caesar is not going to embrace flux or contemporary emergent form, but yet we did the Portuguese Pavilion, and I did that spectacular entrance thing. And what I find is basically with these people, if it's they may have a stylistic approach to certain things, particularly the more classical. I've worked with Jim Sterling and others before. But Rem is in a cusp between the modernist and a newer emergent tradition, say. So it's all different. What we all try to do, though, is imagine space in new ways that are making and entertaining the program of architecture. I think that's what we always try to do. I don't know why, but that's what we try to do. So I think the question of flux is not really, I think in all my work, I'm more interested, if you go back to the theory of the informal as outlined in Informal, the book, it's about locality, juxtaposition of localities, which lead to rhythmic intervention, to expansion of localities leading to hybridity. I think that is the new analysis of form and cities particularly. And Terry Farrell, who's doing a huge master plan book and big guru of master planning, urban planning in London, was talking to me recently after he read Informal. He hadn't read Informal till recently. And I'm now talking to him about, he's very intrigued about this concept of locality, hybridity, and juxtaposition. What it is, it refuses to have simplistic categories to an invention in urbanism or architectural building form. I refuse, basically, to be reductive. Uh-huh. Fundamentally, I absolutely reject reductive thinking, as Koestler called it, ratomorphism. You follow the trail. You can always reinvent the space. And it's the simplest of moves. One corner, moving or tilting. I've done various tests that haven't been published, but one day I will. Just moving simple grids, certain localities being pushed against each other, and things happen again. The buildings, just simple forms, release themselves again. You don't have to be flux or curvilinear. For me, the flux is in the potential for a point to be moved. So that in Informal I wrote, I reject a point, I'm considering a zone. I reject a beam line, I think of diaphragm, and so on. I broaden the language so that the architectural down projection, it's a zone that can be reduced to a point. But if you engage with the zone of an area, Arnhem, the thing I did with Ben van Berkel, that's all about zone and diaphragm, and nothing about point, column, line, plane, whatever. There are different takes. I move it up one deliberately to an area I don't know. It's like one of my students here, a group is doing 4D work, projecting to 3D. You don't know what that unseen thing is. When I talk of zone, I'm not very clear, but I know when I reduce it, I'll get a point. So it's a kind of whole process of creativity which refuses to be reductive. And I entertain this process, which is risk because I do not know the outcomes in some ways, but I know when I start to approach them, I'll be able to negotiate my way to a solution of architecture or building and structure or whatever.
Can you talk a bit about constraints? At one point in the book, you talk about this kind of, on the one hand, this desire to not be reductive or to be reduced, but on the other hand, the need for constraints to kind of...
You have to have constraint. I think the biggest problem we got with the computer is its power, and in uneducated hands, it looks infinitely exciting, and that you can... It's going to give you answers. Actually, a computer basically gives you noise in this sense. You can get so much out of it. So it is a risk. It's good to have constraints. Usually in real projects, the budget and the site is a constraint, the budget above all. All these projects I showed had huge crises on budgets. And then you get to negotiating and you get it. So there are constraints. The other constraint is your own training. You can't allow something to go out. I have an analogy like, I like to fly a kite, but you've got to be walking the ground to be able to fly that kite. So there's no point not being trained and then told to fly kites, because you'll be off somewhere else. You'll never be able to build anything. You have to get some basic training to understand before you fly the kite. So it's that, you know, it's the constraints are necessary. Clients, the Tate Gallery, I had a bean thing that was interesting and Anish Kapoor loved it. The client didn't want it for some strange reasons about don't quite know what, and we weren't that hung up on it, so we let it go. So there are kind of constraints as well. And you need to have self-restraint. If you're not critical about your own process, particularly in a new agenda, if you're pursuing it, you don't have reference. You don't have a legacy of looking back and saying, I'll pick that. You need to be able to calibrate yourself so that you actually come out again as a success. And the success is a happy client. Hopefully people were happy with the building, and professionally a reorder. Because otherwise you go out of business. So I'm in the business of building and being wanted by my clients to build again because they're happy with the outcome, though they might be questioning it at the beginning.
I have just one or two concluding questions. At one point, kind of towards the end of the book, there's one of these non-paginated interludes with a philosophical meditation on time, dimension, reality. You speak about dream, about duration, about desire, about feeling, but you also talk about the need for, I think, the architect and the engineer to transcend an obsession with money and achievement. And it's kind of just one line embedded in that mm-hmm. section. And then you move on to talk about practicalities being on the x-axis and the virtual yeah. being on the y-axis. Anyway, given that we're in a school and given that students are in the audience, I was wondering if you could talk about that. It's not a triangulation, it's like kind of a tension or a kind of a...
Yeah, no, I have always been fascinated by time, and we're trained by clocks to think tick-tock, but we all know time is very different. So I'm proposing there a discussion on body event time and body time. The body is constrained to the clock time because of our biological cells. They live and die. And we're locked into a certain duration. It's crazy to think there is not a linear time ticking. We live and die. And our cells do that every day. So there are little bits of perturbations going on, living and dying as well. So we own a body clock. The body is constrained to three dimensions in this world. When you're constrained to three dimensions, you're on a linear plot of time, basically. No escape. But emotional time is all over the place, and we could be infinite in emotional time. So true time is a function of your personality and your culture and your education. And I propose that actually, when if studied properly, it will have a self-similar organization, that certain personalities will repeat themselves at small scale and big scale. And it's a function of your personality, whether you become fatalistic or opportunist or extrovert, whatever. Focus on event time, on the body axis, leads to money, aggregation, power, and legislation. So I put that all down. Spirit time, emotional time, leads to nirvana, looking at your navel, various things. And we need both.
And so our challenge is to kind of meander that.
It's a meandering through. And I like what Leonardo da Vinci said. He said, what you need is first to be an artist. No, first to be a human being. That's the top. Second category is you're an artist at whatever you do. Third is you're a craftsman. And bottom of the list, you're an expert. I think there's something very true in that. You show me a real expert, I find someone who's almost not human, totally dull, and certainly not artistic. So, I propose this work, whether you like it or not, I'm trying to say, in architecture, which is very close to art in many ways, but it's not art, and that's a major mistake a lot of architects make, thinking it's art. It's not. But architecture is a fascinating play of aesthetics and functionalism, which you don't quite get in any other profession. So architecture is a cultural product which has social impact and can have political impact. If you look at Marzahn and you look at the constructions that communist Soviet came up with, it was horrendous because people were ciphers, so there was no humanism in it. So as Informal said, and I've said at the beginning here, the new humanism, this is a very provocative statement, is pattern. Now again, I'd say it deliberately. What I mean is the resonator that's in you and your complex wiring with the spaces we make or the cities we walk through. That is a new humanism. It's this simple band that connects idea and metaphor to actual substance. What's the negotiator? That has been a straight line reductive in classical thinking. And I think we are in our infancy still. 2,000 years of architecture has only developed the Greek model to distort it in the last 50 years. Well, that's a very poor strategy. What's needed now, either you keep the Greek model, find new models. And if you do, you need to write about it, you need to provoke the dialogue, you need to have debate, because you're having to create an agenda. And that's what I'm trying to do.
But and maybe I'll just end here, but just to belabor the point about arts and about the aesthetic, it seems to me, I thought I understood here that you were trying to perform some crossover that takes one across all sorts of, let's say, binary kind of understandings, but also crosses the architectural and the aesthetic. And are you kind of distinguishing them from one another so that they can be kind of meandered through and between? Or I thought that the book is trying to perform some or negotiate some, not necessarily resolution, but some, let's say, uncertain space between the aesthetic and between the architectural. But you wouldn't agree with that?
No, I would say the aesthetic is embedded in fragments in the architecture. It's a serial condition, the aesthetic, because parts of the building are simply reduced to functionalism. Other parts open up your senses. I think the question of aesthetics is a very difficult question, because in classical architecture it was studied a lot up to 1890, and great books were written by the Germans on aesthetics. But I think in a modern sense, it's more, I'm interested in what I would call potentiality and kinetics. And I think there are new architectural students do not understand how form can accumulate potential and it can also have its own kinetics. Kinetics played against potentiality is what creates tension in forms. That comes from a postulation I make on sequence and series. Is the world discrete and sequential? Or is it in series, which is a compounded artifact? These are very discussable points about what we do. You know, I have no answers, absolutely none. I mean, I have intuitions which way I go with it. But the books are about that whole field condition of books, the five books when they're all done, will be exploring a new world of connectivity, configuration, without necessarily abandoning old traditional value on proportion. They are at the heart of these books. The algorithm on the Serpentine Pavilion is actually one of the oldest proportions discovered by Pythagoras, Pythagoras, to give him his Greek name, on his first scientific experiment ever done in the world, stretching a string and plucking it and finding the octave. And CCTV is an octave condition on the skin. Serpentine Pavilion is the dominant two-thirds ratio. Never thought that, never planned that. It dropped out. And that's what I find. These processes surprise me. And that's what keeps me going. Otherwise, why do it?
So at the very end of the book, there's a tension that you write about between the rational and the rational being buried in the much larger irrational.
Correct.
And so I guess just to close, could you talk a bit about why you end with the irrational?
For me, it's the slide I showed with the black border. The random is unknown, and then you work towards a convergent outcome. We do it in our own thinking. We jump around and we converge an answer, which is irrational. Rationality is where you can reason out a logical step-by-step process. Irrational just means, not crazy, it's not rationable. It means you jump around to get to an answer. Gossip, human gossip, is a perfect irrational model, but it gets to answers, right?
But haven't you been trying in the book to perform something that would approximate more rationality?
Yeah, but the rationality, the more you explore rationality, you find that actually it's embedded in a wider irrational. Mm-hmm. So the basic condition of this world, and I submit, is irrational, which means you cannot rationalize it, but when you attempt to do it, you're reducing the irrational to what you can do. So it's embedded, by definition, in the bigger irrational.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you. Thank you for coming. Much appreciated. Now you can go buy the book. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you.